This is Steve Carroll, and you're listening to the EM Basic Podcast. Today we're going to do a topic podcast on MI and acute coronary syndromes, also called ACS. This confused the heck out of me as an intern, and it took a while before I could wrap my head around it. Today we're going to focus on how to differentiate the spectrum of acute coronary syndromes and what to do about them. If you need a review on the basic workup of chest pain, go back to the chest pain podcast, because today we're going to focus on ACS and not how to differentiate the various causes of chest pain. Before we get started, I have one quick announcement. I just received IRB approval for a research project on EM Basic and would really appreciate your help. It's a short 10-question survey that will help me improve EM Basic. In addition, I'll also be looking to present the results of the survey at a national conference. So if you have a few minutes, I would really be grateful if you could fill one out. Simply go to embasic.org and click on the link at the top of the page that says Podcast Survey. Please leave your honest feedback and suggestions so I can make this podcast better. Before we get started, as always, this podcast doesn't represent the views or opinions of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, or the Shawshank Emergency Medicine Residency. So let's get started. The first thing that will help you understand ACS is that it's a spectrum. Don't you just love it when people say that? Aren't there so many things in medicine that are a spectrum? So what do we mean by that? It means that ACS represents a wide variety of presentations, and we need to do something different for each part of that spectrum. When it comes down to it, we are really good at either end of the spectrum. We know with about 95% plus accuracy who is low risk and who can be admitted to a chest pain unit for a rule out, and we know what to do when someone comes in with a whopping ST elevation MI. The real difficulty are the patients that fall in between those two presentations, because that's where things aren't so clear cut. So here's the first thing to remember. Not everyone who comes into the hospital with chest pain is having ACS. When we admit patients for a low-risk rule-out, we are ruling out ACS. If we thought they actually had ACS, they would be better served on a cardiology service, most likely the cardiac ICU. So when we admit patients with chest pain who have a story that isn't concerning, a normal EKG, normal cardiac enzymes, and a normal chest x-ray, and pain that goes away with some intervention, then we are admitting to rule out ACS. These patients get serial cardiac enzymes and serial EKGs, and most likely a stress test the next day. These patients don't even fall onto the ACS spectrum unless they rule in with ACS by bumping their enzymes, having EKG changes, or having persistent pain. These are the low-risk patients, and depending on your institution, only about 5% of these low-risk patients will end up being diagnosed with ACS. The reason it's 5% is that we constantly worry about missing ACS because missed MI is the number one payout in emergency medicine lawsuits. Just for some perspective, in other countries, the rule-in rate is about 20% because they send more of these low-risk patients home. I won't launch into a rant on this. I just wanted to give some perspective on the population that we admit for low-risk chest pain. So now we've moved past the low-risk chest pain patient and on to ACS. ACS is composed of three main entities: unstable angina, non-ST elevation MI, and ST elevation MI. Let's go through each one of these entities one at a time. Since this is a progression of disease, we will start with unstable angina and not just jump straight to STEMI right off the bat. It will make more sense this way. First, let's talk about unstable angina, and let me say a few words about the pathophysiology. I know everyone just groaned a little on the inside, but trust me, it will help you understand it a lot better, and I'll keep it short. Unstable angina represents a fixed coronary lesion that causes symptoms when the body is under stress without causing an actual leak of cardiac enzymes. This is where the patient may have a, quote, normal cath, but had 30% stenosis. Usually these patients compensate to overcome this lesion by growing collateral vessels, so it becomes a problem only when they can't compensate anymore. When the patient tries to increase their cardiac output while under some sort of stressor, they get chest pain because they can't overcome that fixed lesion. This lesion is at risk for rupturing and can cause an acute clot, but we'll talk more about that later. Unstable angina is defined as pain that occurs with rest or minimal exertion, any new chest pain, or pain that is different from previous chest pain in either intensity, character, or exertion level. So to boil that down to something that's easy to remember, it's chest pain that occurs at rest, is new, or different. The way I remember this is a random UA, as in random urinalysis. The mnemonic is RNDUA, which stands for rest, new, different, unstable angina. So let me pause here for a second and let you know something. Technically, a 40-year-old patient with low-risk chest pain who has never had this chest pain before classifies as unstable angina because the pain is new, right? While this is technically true, it's not how we practice. When I think of unstable angina, I think of a patient who has difficult-to-control chest pain that is suspicious for cardiac etiology. If you're having a hard time getting the patient's chest pain under control, and you think it's cardiac, you need to treat it as unstable angina. This is where you should get your cardiologist involved and aggressively manage these patients. As far as management of unstable angina, these patients need three main therapies: an antiplatelet agent, anticoagulation, and nitroglycerin. First off, these patients should get 325 mg of chewable aspirin, just like any other patient with suspected cardiac chest pain. If the patient cannot take aspirin because of a true allergy, you can substitute Plavix 75 mg PO instead. Just make sure that your cardiologist knows about this up front. If you're going to be admitting the patient with a diagnosis of unstable angina, they should also be anticoagulated. Just to be clear, anticoagulation does not reduce mortality, but it does reduce the rate of reinfarction down the road. Every cardiologist seems to have their own preference on whether to use heparin or Lovenox in these patients, so I always talk to them before I order anticoagulation. On one hand, heparin can be done as a drip, and it disappears quickly once it is turned off, so it may be preferred in case the patient has a bleeding side effect. On the other hand, there's some data to suggest that patients may have better outcomes with Lovenox and unstable angina and STEMI, but once you've given it, you can't really take it back. So talk to your cardiologist before you anticoagulate these patients, because they will have to deal with the effects of whatever you order, and time is not super critical in this case. You are not going to actively dissolve that stenosis in their coronaries, so you have a few minutes to call your cardiologist. If you really have the itch to start something right away, you can start heparin and then turn it off if you need to. As far as dosing, a heparin drip is dosed at 60 to 70 units per kilogram bolus, then 12 to 15 units per kilogram per hour, with a max bolus of 5,000 units and a max hourly rate of 1,000 units per hour. I'll be honest, I just looked up that dose, and you should too, because it's not something that we do every day. A lot of hospitals have a nomogram to guide your dosing, so you should use that to ensure accuracy as well. If you're going to use Lovenox, it's 1 mg per kilogram sub-Q, which is the same dose as treatment for a pulmonary embolism. It's a lot easier to dose to remember, but once you give it, you've pretty much stuck with it for at least the next 12 hours. The last treatment for unstable angina is nitroglycerin. This will cause coronary vasodilation and should help the patient's chest pain. Just be cautious in patients with a systolic blood pressure below 100 or in those patients with a posterior MI. Also remember that nitro is absolutely contraindicated in those patients taking Viagra, Cialis, or Levitra, so make sure to ask your male patients about any use of these drugs. Nitro will decrease preload and afterload and decrease the work of the heart. So we were experts at writing that order for sublingual nitro, but let's go one step further and understand how much nitro these tablets give you per minute. Each nitro sublingual tablet is 0.4 milligrams, or 400 micrograms. Each tablet releases nitro over the span of about 5 minutes. So that's 400 micrograms of nitro over 5 minutes, which equals 80 mics per minute. I'm a big fan of sublingual nitro because it's quickly available and easy to give, whereas a nitro drip takes some time to set up. When you start out that nitro drip, the tendency is to start the drip low at 10 to 20 micrograms per minute and slowly titrate up. So now you've gone from 80 micrograms per minute to only 10 micrograms per minute. Everyone has a different comfort level of where to start a nitro drip, but unless you start at around 80 micrograms per minute, you are going backwards on your dosing compared to the sublinguals. So if the patient has a systolic over 100, keep dialing up that dose until their chest pain feels better. You can also try morphine, but if they get a ton better with nitro, then you have to think that you're on the right track. Once you have the patient stabilized in the ED, these patients will most likely be admitted to the cardiac ICU. They will most likely get a cardiac catheterization done on an urgent basis compared to right away for a STEMI. In the end, unstable angina gives us the most trouble because it's a rather subjective definition. Technically, a patient with severe musculoskeletal chest pain that doesn't get it better with opioids is unstable angina, but it's more about putting the entire picture together and making a decision as to whether you think this chest pain is cardiac or not. So real quick, let's review unstable angina. Unstable angina represents a fixed lesion in the coronaries that causes chest pain while under stress. This is chest pain that occurs at rest, is new, or is different from the previous pain. This is a patient with persistent chest pain despite interventions that would normally decrease chest pain, but without any cardiac enzyme elevation or EKG changes. They are treated with aspirin, anticoagulation with either heparin drip or Lovenox, and nitroglycerin titrated to a systolic BP of 100 or until they're chest pain-free. They get admitted, usually to the cardiac ICU, and they're usually cathed on an urgent basis. Now let's talk about non-ST elevation MI or NSTEMI. A patient with an NSTEMI has progressed further than unstable angina and has an elevation of their troponin. This means that their fixed lesion has caused enough stenosis to cause myocardial cell damage and death. This is what we call type 1 NSTEMI. However, most NSTEMIs occur in combination with some other stressor, and these are type 2 NSTEMIs. The classic scenario for a type 2 NSTEMI is an older patient with or without previously diagnosed heart disease who is under stress from something else besides their heart. For example, if they are really sick from sepsis or trauma or anything that will make them tachycardic for long periods of time, you'll see that the patients have an elevation in their cardiac enzymes. This represents cell death from stress to the heart and probably not an acute occlusion. So one more time, a patient with an NSTEMI is a patient with an elevation in their troponin, but no evidence of ST elevation MI. They can have depressions and T-wave changes, but they don't meet criteria for an MI because they don't have ST elevations of more than 1 millimeter in two or more contiguous leads. If you see diffuse depressions, meaning ST elevations in most leads, then this is most likely what we call rate-related ischemia. The one caution here is that if the patient has depressions in an anatomic distribution, you have to be concerned for ischemia or infarction opposite of those leads. For example, if they have depressions in only V2 and V3, which are anterior septal leads, then you have to be suspicious for a posterior wall MI, so you should check a right-sided and posterior EKG. There's a great mnemonic that one of my attendings taught me to remember where to look for reciprocal changes with elevations or depressions. It's PAILS, P-A-I-L-S. It stands for posterior, anterior, inferior, lateral, and septal. The way you use this is to find the area where you are starting from and then go to the next letter. That is the area where you should see changes. So if you have changes in your posterior leads, look at your anterior leads. If you have changes in your anterior leads, look at your inferior leads, and so on. So you have a patient with chest pain, EKG changes without anatomic ST elevations, and troponin leak. So what's your next step? Fortunately, these patients are managed with the same interventions as those with unstable angina, but you have to consider their underlying cause if they have one. For the type 1 NSTEMIs who don't have an underlying stressor like sepsis or trauma that's causing their NSTEMI, get them 325 milligrams of aspirin, a nitroglycerin drip if they're still having chest pain, and your cardiologist's anticoagulant of choice, either heparin or Lovenox. Consult the cardiology service and admit them to a monitored setting, most likely the cardiac ICU. Now, type 2 NSTEMIs are a different animal because they have an underlying cause to their NSTEMI that must be treated. You will see this frequently in the sick and septic nursing home patients because their illness puts a tremendous strain on an old heart. The number one treatment for these patients is to treat the underlying cause of their stressor. If they're septic, get them fluids and antibiotics and early goal-directed therapy if they qualify. If they have a GI bleed and a hemoglobin of 3, resuscitate them and give them blood. You have to let the clinical picture be your guide. It would be really wrong to say that all NSTEMIs get aspirin, anticoagulation, and nitro, because that would harm your patients with type 2 NSTEMIs. That patient with a GI bleed and a hemoglobin of 3 would not like you too much if you anticoagulated them. Overall, these patients don't complain of chest pain a lot. They usually get a troponin drawn because they are super sick, or they have some EKG changes that are concerning, and we happen to find an elevated troponin. Most of these type 2 NSTEMIs will have their enzymes trended as an inpatient, and if they develop a really high troponin or bad cardiac chest pain after their underlying stressor has been fixed, they will be taken to the cath lab. This isn't a decision that we have to make in the ED. Bottom line, in someone with a type 2 NSTEMI, treat their underlying cause and let the inpatient team trend their enzymes. So let's go over NSTEMI one more time. Patients with NSTEMI are those with elevated troponins plus or minus EKG changes. They don't meet criteria for an ST elevation MI, although they can have ST depressions and T-wave changes that look worrisome. We divide NSTEMIs into type 1 and type 2. Type 1 NSTEMIs have troponin leaks without an underlying non-cardiac stressor and are treated with, like unstable angina, with 325 milligrams of aspirin, anticoagulation with heparin or Lovenox, and nitro if they're having chest pain. Type 2 NSTEMIs is a patient with the same troponin leak but under stress from another condition like sepsis or trauma. A type 2 NSTEMI is often caused by prolonged tachycardia. The key here is to treat their underlying condition, and that will likely resolve their troponin leak. Finally, let's talk about ST elevation MI, or STEMI. This is the most serious end of the ACS spectrum in the fact that we have to do something about it immediately. This is where we spend all of our time, money, and resources making sure that we meet that relatively arbitrary door-to-balloon time standard of 90 minutes. I'm sure most of the listeners out there have witnessed one of these code STEMIs or code hearts or whatever you call it before. A whole gaggle of people rush down to the ER and whisk the patient upstairs to the cath lab. It's actually kind of nice because these sick patients leave the ED very quickly and we can get on with our shift. We'll talk more about that in a second. First, let's address STEMI starting with the pathophysiology. An ST elevation MI represents an acute occlusion of a coronary vessel. The typical scenario is a patient who already has a small plaque in their coronary arteries, but who has a rupture of that plaque. This exposes the inside of the plaque, which causes platelets to aggregate and form a clot inside the coronary artery. This is usually manifested by severe chest pain, usually described as pressure, diaphoresis, nausea, pain into the left arm and jaw, and so on. One little pearl to keep in mind is that if your patient is sweating, you should be sweating. Some presentations of STEMIs will be very dramatic. Other STEMIs will be more subtle, and you'll catch them by the skin of your teeth. Either way, the diagnostic criteria for a STEMI is 1 millimeter of elevation in two contiguous leads, or a new or presumed new left bundle branch block pattern, along with symptoms that suggest a cardiac origin. Just an FYI, at the moment, a new left bundle branch block pattern is a criteria for an immediate cardiac catheterization, but don't be surprised if you see this guideline change in the next few years, because very few of these patients actually rule in for an MI. As far as the EKG and STEMI, you can easily search Google Images and find great pictures of what this elevation looks like, or go to your favorite EKG book. If you have a patient with chest pain and evidence of a STEMI, you need to activate your cath lab or arrange for an immediate transfer to a hospital with a cath lab available. I won't talk about thrombolytics and STEMI because we use them so rarely and the instances where you would use them could take up a whole podcast on its own. So patients going to the cath lab get the usual 325 milligrams of PO aspirin, and most cardiologists want the patient loaded with 600 milligrams of PO Plavix. This is a big dose of Plavix, and I learned very quickly to give the patients a prophylactic dose of Zofran because a lot of people vomit this back up. So give your patient 8 milligrams of Zofran IV before you give the oral Plavix. Finally, most cardiologists will want a heparin drip as well, so set that up as you're talking with the cardiologist on call. The textbook will say to give a bolus dose followed by a drip, but I've also seen some cardiologists who prefer no bolus. Once again, get on board with your cardiologist regarding these interventions, just to make sure you're on the same page regarding the Plavix and heparin. Once you've diagnosed a STEMI, it seems like a lot of these patients are taken away from us very quickly. This is a good thing because they need to get to the cath lab quickly, but it's a bad thing if we rush them through things and we don't figure out that the patient has another cause for their STEMI. So after you've activated the cath lab, take a few minutes before all the chaos starts and get a good history and physical and a chest x-ray. Aortic dissection can present as an ST elevation MI if it involves the coronary arteries, so you need to make sure that the history and physical and the chest x-ray don't suggest an aortic dissection. On the chest x-ray, you'll be looking for a widened mediastinum, although this is only 70% sensitive for dissection. Sometimes it can be really tough to differentiate a dissection from an MI, but keep in mind that a dissection can be diagnosed by a cardiac cath that goes through the groin. However, you'll want to make it clear to your cardiologist that you're concerned about this so they aren't loaded with heparin or Plavix and make the dissection worse. The classic example of an MI mimic on EKG is pericarditis. This is an inflammation of the pericardial sac that causes chest pain and diffuse ST elevations. Any good EKG book will have several examples of what these EKGs look like. I won't go into this anymore. Just know that pericarditis can mimic a STEMI. Also keep in mind that there could be something going on outside of the heart that causes ST elevations that look like an MI. The classic example of this is a patient with an intracerebral hemorrhage. For whatever reason, patients with head bleeds can have ST elevations, so make sure their history and physical doesn't support this. I've also read about patients with ruptured AAAs that get whisked off to the cath lab because they had ST elevations. Here's the bottom line. Make sure to not shut off your brain once you see ST elevations. You may only have a few minutes to get a good history and physical and chest x-ray before the cath team shows up and causes all sorts of chaos. Think of yourself as the last line of defense. Once the cath team shows up, they will focus on the heart and the heart alone, so you will be the last person to consider the rest of the other organ systems. So let's review STEMI one more time. A STEMI represents a plaque that ruptures and causes an acute clot in the coronary arteries with cardiac cell death. STEMI is diagnosed in patients with chest pain with 1 mm of ST elevations in two or more contiguous EKG leads, or a new or presumed new left bundle branch block pattern in their EKG. These patients get 325 mg of aspirin, a heparin drip, and 600 mg of PO Plavix with a Zofran chaser. Make sure to get a good history and physical and chest x-ray. Look for a widened mediastinum that can suggest aortic dissection. Pericarditis can be confused with STEMI, but the elevations are diffuse instead of focal in one anatomic area. Look out especially for intracerebral hemorrhage and aortic dissection as non-cardiac causes of ST elevation. If you have any suspicion for aortic dissection, make sure to tell your cardiologist and hold off on any anticoagulation until you rule that out either with a cath or a CT. One last time here, are the big take-home points. ACS is a spectrum. Unstable angina are patients with difficult-to-control chest pain without enzyme leak. NSTEMI are patients with elevated cardiac enzymes without ST elevations in their EKG. And finally, STEMI is a patient with ST elevations or a new left bundle branch block with chest pain. So that's all I have for now. Stay tuned for a short bonus section on cardiac risk factors. Do they help us at all when diagnosing ACS in the ED? The answer may surprise you. Also, don't forget to take the EM Basic survey. Go to embasic.org and click on the link that says podcast survey at the top of the page. As always, feel free to email me with comments or suggestions at steve@embasic.org. I'm still working on show summaries, and I will post them once I have a few more done. Until next time, this is Steve Carroll with the EM Basic podcast signing off. Now it's time for a quick bonus section. Let's say that you have a patient in the ED with chest pain. Should their cardiac risk factors matter when we are considering whether or not they're having ACS? The short answer is no, and here's why. So when we talk about cardiac risk factors, we talk about things like hypertension, diabetes, smoking, family history of MI, and high cholesterol. So how do we know that these things put you at risk for coronary artery disease? These risk factors were derived from the Framingham studies. In 1948, the Framingham studies were a cohort of patients in Framingham, Massachusetts, who were followed with physical exams and lab tests every 2 years. This study helped us figure out that things like hypertension and diabetes were risk factors for coronary artery disease because they correlated those risk factors with the risk of developing coronary artery disease years down the road. So this seems pretty reasonable. If you have lots of risk factors for coronary heart disease, then it must mean that someone in the ED with chest pain must have a higher risk for ACS, right? Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. The risk factors that we talk about a lot predict the patient's long-term risk for developing coronary artery disease. It doesn't tell us whether that patient in front of us is having ACS right this second. Risk factors are only useful for predicting long-term risk of CAD. They are useless in the short term. They tell you that this patient in front of you has a higher than average risk of CAD in the next 10 years. It doesn't tell you whether they're at higher risk for ACS while sitting in front of you with chest pain. So how are we supposed to use risk factors for CAD in the ED? Here's my take. Risk factors are useful because they raise your antennae for the possibility of atypical presentations of MI. Diabetics and females are notorious for having atypical ACS presentations. Instead of that classic picture in Netter of a 60-year-old man clutching his chest, a female patient with ACS may just feel weak, or have severe nausea, or even the dreaded weak and dizzy. So a diabetic female should make you very concerned for an atypical presentation. Here's the real pitfall with risk factors. Don't let someone talk you out of admitting a patient with chest pain because they lack risk factors. Sometimes our cardiologist colleagues will perseverate over the fact that a patient lacks risk factors and then say that the patient doesn't need to be admitted. I would encourage you to not be swayed by a lack of risk factors when choosing whether or not to admit a patient for an ACS rule-out. So in the end, the presence of risk factors raises my antennae a little bit, but the lack of risk factors doesn't change anything for me. That's it for now. This is Steve Carroll for the EM Basic Podcast, signing off.